Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
My name is Audra McDonald, and you're listening to 11, the official theater podcast.
Hello and welcome to 11, the official theatre podcast that brings the biggest stars and creatives together in one place to discuss life in the arts. She's the Emmy, Grammy and six-time Tony Award-winning powerhouse that's officially the most decorated star in Broadway history. A Juilliard-trained soprano, she was inducted into the American Theatre Hall of Fame in 2017, has performed at the White House, and in 2016, she was awarded the National Medal of the Arts by President Obama. With Ragtime, Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, Porgy and Bess alongside The Good Wife, Beauty and the Beast, and The Sound of Music on screen, alongside many, many more, she really has been there, done that, and probably won a Tony Award for it too. And this September plays the London Palladium as she brings a solo show all of her own, featuring the joys of the Great American Songbook. She is, by all possible descriptions, one of the finest that's ever walked onto a Broadway stage. So here, in an exclusive conversation direct from her home in the United States, we discuss bringing a touch of Broadway magic to London as she headlines at the London Palladium in her very own solo show, how she's fought against expectations to find her true and own voice and style, and why she regularly fails and isn't cast, even with six Tony Awards to her name. But that's okay, it's life, and more people should know the truth about both the successes and challenges of the performing arts world. What it was like performing that Dreamgirls cast album, and how Beyoncé ended up listening to it. And why no matter where she goes in the world, there's always two songs she just can't escape fans wanting to hear. She is the Queen of Broadway. It's icon Audra McDonald, here now on this, the next episode of 11, the official theatre podcast. To ensure the safety of all involved in this episode of 11, Audra and I connected for this conversation digitally, so please forgive any brief moments while we wait for the internet to catch up. Enjoy. Please help me welcome to this, the next episode of 11. She's the Emmy, Grammy and six-time Tony Award-winning powerhouse that's heading to British shores to raise the roof of the world-famous London Palladium stage. With her correct royal title new today, hello, Dame Audra McDonald. How are you?
Dame Audra McDonald. Oh my goodness. I'm fine. I'm better now for being called that.
So you approve of your new title, where I'm okay to call you Dame Audra for now, right?
Yeah, I've got no problem with it. Maybe you can get my family to call me that.
Be like, I have a new title. I'd really respect it if you used it now. Thank you, family. Love you.
Yes, exactly. See how long that lasts.
Because you've worked just on the Dame thing with Emma Thompson, right? Do you call her Dame Emma when you speak to her?
Sure. Hell no. No, sorry. I don't call her Dame. I call her M.
That feels a lot more professional and a lot more friendly as well. So maybe we'll go that. I don't feel like we know each other well enough yet for me to call you A. So maybe I'll call you just Dame Audra and we'll work with that.
Call me whatever you'd like.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. And I should say that, as you can probably tell from the excitement in my voice, this is really, really special for us here in the UK because we're getting you back on British shores, which I know it's been a little bit of a while. It's the London Palladium. It's basically, I think, one of, if not the most famous theatre in the world. It's literally had every superstar in the entire world. And I know that London audiences have been incredibly kind to you. Right now, we're roughly about a month out from you coming to British shores. How are you feeling?
I'm so excited to come come back to London and to perform there. It's just one of my favorite cities in the entire world. And anytime I get a chance to come and visit or perform, I'm just always thrilled. Actually, the last time I was in London was in February, because my daughter did a semester abroad there. So I went and visited her there, and we walked by the Palladium late one night and took pictures and you know, was like, I'll be here soon. But so any chance I get to come, for whatever reason, I'm there. So that the fact that I get to come and be with an orchestra and sing some of my favorite songs, and you know, this place that, I mean, the people that have performed there, my goodness. I mean, for me, any stage that I get to step on that, you know, that Judy Garland was on, I'm happy to be there.
And it doesn't matter, regardless of how successful you become in your career, how many awards you get, roles you've had, to get the opportunity to play on a stage like the London Palladium, like, that will never become normal, right?
No. I mean, I feel the same way there that I do about, you know, when I get to perform at Carnegie Hall. You know, it's just one of those, it's just one of those iconic places. And for some reason, and maybe I'll eat my words, I find that I get very, very nervous leading up to when I walk out on the stage. And then the moment I walk out on the stage, the nerves go away, because there's something about the fact that that, like Carnegie Hall, it was built for music. It's built for what you're doing there. So something about it is, as soon as you walk on the stage, at Carnegie anyway, I just feel like, oh, this is what you're supposed to be doing here. And it also becomes almost sacred in a way. And so I'm hoping that I'll have that same experience in the Palladium and just sort of feel the ghosts of all the people who have performed before me and get out there and do my thing, you know, and pay homage to, you know, Lena Horne was there, Ella Fitzgerald's performed there, you know, I mean, just everybody. So I'm just thrilled.
And also, you're performing on Sunday, the 25th of September, which is a Sunday night. And Sunday night at the London Palladium is like famous for us Brits. Like, it's such a monumental evening. So it's sort of, I feel like you've basically got everything in your favor to go out there and just absolutely kill it.
Well, for me, you know, I don't ever think of it in terms of like, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to knock them dead, or I'm gonna kill it. For me, I think I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna try and make that space as intimate as possible and turn it into just sort of like a communion. You know, I'm not a super religious person. I probably sound like it because I've said sacred once and now I'm saying communion. I was raised religious, you know, Episcopalian, but I'm not that anymore. But I do sort of appreciate what live performance, what sort of spirituality kind of comes out of live performance. There's a sharing of a human condition. There's a sharing of emotions that happens, you know, when you're all united in a space like that. As I think Bill Braun said, he was one of the great Broadway orchestrators. He passed away some years ago, but he orchestrated the revival of Carousel that I did. He also orchestrated Ragtime, but many Broadway shows. And he said, you know, when people come into the theater, they check their brains with their hats, but they keep their hearts. And I love that. I don't want to kill it. I just want to like all of us to go out feeling like we really know each other in a spiritual way. Okay, I'll stop talking now. You talk now.
Less killing, more like teasing and loving, right? Like something fun, playful.
Yes.
Maybe that was my fault in using the word killing, but you know, just like, what do the kids say? Is like slay or something? Like, yeah, you're just gonna go out there and or just gonna slay. How about that?
Oh yeah, I guess so. You know, I can't keep up. I've got a 21-year-old, I've got two 21-year-olds, an 18-year-old and a 5-year-old. And between all those generations there, I can't keep up with any of the sayings, but maybe slay, I don't know. But I feel like that's even passé now to say, I don't know.
I love the fact that we're teaching each other very strange words to absolutely just go out and do your job and love life, like slay it. It's a strange world. Anyway, talk to me about what happens when somebody brings an opportunity to perform on the London Palladium to you. And of course, the excitement happens and you go, yes, absolutely, I'd love to come to the UK again. What about when you actually have to build the show? Is there a specific thing that you want to explore? Is this something that we've not heard from you? I guess, what does an Audra McDonald at the Palladium show sound, look and feel like?
Well, this one I think is going to, you know, I perform all over the place, and I most of my concerts, you know, from time to time I do orchestral concerts in larger cities in the US, and I've done some in London, you know, at the proms and whatnot, but I perform mostly with a trio. And so that is, you know, although I do some of the similar repertoire, that experience is more of
it feels smaller in scale. So the fact that I'm going to have this orchestra to sort of literally play with, we wanted to, you know, look back at an era that, you know, just were big orchestras and, you know, like the golden age of singers, you know, like people I've mentioned, Judy Garland, Lena Horne, Ella Fitzgerald, you know, Sammy Davis Jr., all those people. So so it's given me an opportunity to do perhaps some more classic songs from the, you know, the Broadway repertoire in really good, big, old-fashioned, largely orchestrated numbers. So I'm leaning a little bit toward that, just because I'm having this opportunity to have this great large group of musicians to work with. So there's going to be, you know, a lot of Sondheim, there's going to be a lot of Irving Berlin, there's going to be there's going to be Johnny Mercer and Mancini, there's going to be Kander and Ebb, there's going to be Comden and Green, Rodgers and Hammerstein, I mean, Gershwin, we're really, you know, going there in that. And but at the same time, there's also going to be a few surprises as well, which I don't want to give away, but there will be a few surprises, numbers that no one's ever heard me sing before, including myself. I will have sung them once or twice before Sunday night.
Oh, good. I was going to say, what a stage to try something new out.
Yeah, which is just, that's just typical of me. Let me just find the biggest possible places to possibly fall flat on my face. But that's what makes it exciting, right?
Absolutely. Are you the sort of person that does try and test yourself even in those big venues? Or are you the sort of person that relies on the fact that you want to feel comfortable? How does it usually play out creatively?
I do try and test myself. And at the same time, I want to feel comfortable. Yeah. But I think, again, that has to do with just like my personality, because I used to pass out a lot on stages when I was performing earlier in my career, literally mid-performance, I would pass out. So for me, it's always sort of now every time I step on stage, there's always that in the back of my head is like, am I going to be conscious by the end of this concert? Gosh, I hope so. That's my plan. let me not do things that are going to scare me into passing out. But at the same time, I kind of get a thrill out of that. So it's like people who skydive, I guess. For me, skydiving is, you know, getting out there and seeing if I could do it. But I also don't want to miss this opportunity too. So for me, it's like, yeah, I want to try some of the pieces that I'm going to be doing with this big orchestra, and I don't want to miss this opportunity. And so, you know, how do you practice with a big orchestra until you have a big orchestra to, you know, perform with? You just wait until you can. And so, yeah, there's going to be a little bit of, there'll be a couple of numbers that'll feel like tightrope walking for me, but if I succeed, it'll be thrilling. And the other kind of scary part always seems to be when you're doing classics that people know super well and have a really specific idea of how they're supposed to be performed. And so there's always the added sort of pressure of that and wanting to make something your own and yet honor the piece as well. And I enjoyed that challenge because what I've learned in all my thousands of years of performing now is that you can't try and sound like other people. And I know that's old advice, and it's sage advice, and it's cliche for a reason. It's absolutely true. And so a lot of some of these classic pieces that I'm going to be doing, some of the most iconic singers of this era have sung them, and I admire and revere their performances, but I have to make it my own in order to sort of succeed at singing these songs. And so that's the challenge.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Do you think by doing that, in making sure that you're celebrating and paying homage and tribute to some of the very many people that you've just mentioned, has been one of the successful points of your career that's allowed you to stay true to yourself because you wanted to do your version of it as opposed to trying to be there, which I think is a trap that a lot of people either accidentally or in some cases deliberately fall down when trying to find their place in the industry. Do you think that individuality has served you well?
I think so. And I think it's, you know, because you learn too. I did try and sound like all of those people early on in my career. Absolutely did. And it wasn't, it didn't work. And it was only when I really started to trust and really, you know, started to see that that's where my success lay in being truer to my own voice and my own sound and my own interpretation of these pieces and whatnot. That's where I found success. And so I trust that now.
Yeah.
I trust it.
Does coming to different locations outside of the US open you up to fans' thoughts on certain things that they love the most about you? Roles and perhaps songs that you sing. Are you always intrigued by what someone says? I love it when you sing this, and you think, oh, I've not heard anybody mention that in a while. Is that always quite fun?
Yes. And also, I think for me, because I'm traveling outside of the country and because most of what I do, you know, especially when I do Broadway shows, you know, you do them here in New York and seldom do I get the opportunity to travel outside and do concerts and whatnot outside of the country. So I'm always sort of stunned that I have fans outside of the United States. I was like, oh, you know that? And maybe some of the work tends to be more stuff that's, you know, been televised or stuff that's, you know, on film. You know, like even every once in a while, someone's like, well, why don't you sing something for Beauty and the Beast? I guess I could. I didn't think about that, you know?
Are there regular things that fans do mention a lot? You know, do they mention Ragtime a lot? Do they mention Stars on the Moon? Are there sort of patterns that you notice?
Yes, absolutely. Stars in the Moon is always one. I do get a lot of Ragtime. I get a lot of the Sound of Music because of that live production. Yeah, those are the main ones I get that are pretty common. I remember being in Madrid doing a concert in Madrid and was stunned at how many people in the audience knew the words to a lot of the songs that I was singing and my versions of them. So that was also very stunning for me, to the point where I was able to have them sing it, you know, with me. And I was like, wow, this is great. So that's always such a pleasant and beautiful surprise for me.
So when you're putting together a show for the Palladium, do you try and include them or do you want to do something new? I guess, how does the balancing act work?
It is a balance. You know, my music director, Andy Einhorn, and I it's like a menu in a really great restaurant. That's what we're trying to put together. You know, you want to have a really good appetizer, you want a muse-bouche, you want like a good first, second, third course, you want that main course to be amazing, you want the palate cleansers, you want the dessert to be really something, and then, you know, we really try and build a journey, an oral journey, A-U-R-A-L, journey. It's painstaking, it's very deliberate. The song placement is very deliberate, not only for, you know, what's happening emotionally, what type of song, whether it's a ballad, up tempo, whether it's comedic, also where it sits vocally within my range. Like if I'm doing a bunch of really, 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 really high stuff, the next song can't be a really, really low song because it takes a minute for me to get my voice kind of back down. You know what I mean? So everything is, it may sort of seem like, hey, now we're going to do this number. And what do you think about this number? It's all very specifically and carefully thought out.
I mentioned songs, but I guess the beauty of doing stuff in person, particularly as you mentioned, when you go around the globe, is that you get to find out how the music has changed people. And I think it's almost the other side of the performing arts world. But I think it's equally as important is how does this art form and this industry change, enhance, and hopefully improve people's lives. And I know so many people reference your Tony Award-winning speeches, and I think it was used with Ariana this year on the opening. I'm sure you've seen that. But do people talk to you about some of the things that you've said and the speeches, and do they talk about your work and how it's impacted their lives?
Yes, absolutely. You know, because I've been very honest about, you know, my life and my struggles and, you know, my triumphs. I've not, you know, sort of tried to hide anything. I've been very honest about, you know, my suicide attempt that I had when I was back in at Juilliard. I've been very honest about the fact that I have ADD and ADHD, and that's something that I've had since I was a child. And how that affected me in you know a positive way, honestly, just to let people know that, you know, I'm fully formed, complicated individual. And to be honest about that, I think makes other people feel seen. Like, and that I think people can look at my career and say, oh, well, everything's gone right for her in her life. Well, look at that. I mean, she's just, it's just, you know, it's, that's not me. It's like, no, actually this. And through lots of luck and lots of opportunity and really hard work, I was able to achieve. But because I was able to achieve, you can too. And I think also representation is so important. So especially for young Black women that see me, you know, see someone that looks like them up there. And who's, you know, gone through what I've gone through, you know, get to that place in their life where they can have the success. I think seeing examples of that is inspirational. And so So I guess that's a long way of answering your question, that many times when people come up and speak to me or talk to me about, you know, my Tony speeches or just the type of songs that I've chosen or the fact that I am, you know, a Black female soprano and that I've let my voice be my voice and not been pressured into making it sound like something that might be considered, well, you're a Black woman, you should be able to, like, you know, just give me all the sassy stuff. You know what I mean? All of that. I've been able to forge my own path. I think that's important, and that is something especially a lot of young Black women and girls have said to me. And then other people have spoken to me about, thank you for speaking out for LGBTQIA, that community, and, you know, and just for the, you know, the work I try and do with homeless, you know. So I think all of that kind of comes back when I'm, you know, I'm meeting fans and stuff, and that's very moving to me. That's very moving to me. Makes me feel, you know, it makes me feel good.
Is perception quite difficult to manage then with the success and the opportunities, but also the challenges that you've had? You know, do you often hear people say, well, of course she got the role, she's got 6 Tony Awards, of course she's had this success? Because I know, knowing people like you in the industry, that they might think something, but the reality really isn't the same.
Absolutely not. And the thing I think people don't realize is they don't see all the stuff we don't get. I mean, how many people, I mean, maybe you hear it in interviews and stuff, and I'm honest about that too, but how many times, you know, does someone say, oh, guess what role I didn't get today? Or they post on Instagram, today I'm not cast in, but I had 6 auditions for, you know, I mean, that still goes on. That still goes on to this day. I mean, for me in my career. And so I try and be honest about that stuff as well. And also the fact that it's, you don't just start, you know, you don't just make it and then it's all of a sudden, well, I don't have to do voice lessons anymore and I don't have to work hard at it anymore. It just all comes to me. No, it's all still a grind. It's all still a grind, but we do it because we love it, you know, and I'm lucky enough to have had success in what I've been doing, but it's not like it just, I just sit back and eat bonbons and it comes to me. It's still absolutely a grind and it's still a hustle. It's still a hustle.
The reason why I ask is because I think that the industry doesn't always lean into that level of honesty that you present first. And I think it's incredibly vulnerable to speak so honestly, but I feel like we as a collective are getting better at doing this, but I think we right. still need to keep doing it because it's important that people don't think that you get one thing, you get everything. You know, you've got to keep working and being a better person at your job, being better generally, and also being a team player. That's also Absolutely. Important, right?
Absolutely. And I also think that work begets work. And by that, and I tell a lot of young people that are wanting to go into the business and, you know, how do I start? And well, how do I just sort of do exactly what you did? And it's like, well, everybody has their own path. But I tell a lot of people, one must, you know, don't turn your nose up at, you know, opportunities that may not feel like, well, this isn't Broadway, so I'm not going to do it. It's like, yeah, but it's a chance for you to, you know, have practical application of your craft on a stage. It's for you to actually have that interaction between the audience and yourself. I mean, I did, and then I explained a lot of the stuff that I did when I was starting out. I sang with Seth Rudetsky on Thursday nights in AIDS, prison AIDS wards in hospitals where prisoners were too ill to be with AIDS, were too ill to be in the hospital in the prison system. So they had to be transferred to a high security spot in a regular New York hospital, and they were all dying. And this was in the late 80s, early 90s. And I would go in and perform with Seth Rudetsky. We would perform for them. And first of all, they were some of the best audiences I've ever had. And it was a chance for me to work on my audition material. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was sitting there singing, and these were brutally honest audience members. They had nothing to lose, nothing to gain. They had nothing, you know, and they would say things like, you don't seem like you're comfortable singing that one. Or, oh yeah, but when you sang like that, yeah, you were smiling and it seemed like you were happy, or nah, that one. Brutally honest. And I evolved because of that, you know. And can you imagine if I turned my nose up at that experience? Do you know what I mean? And so I always tell them, you know, take any experience, if it's children's theater, if it's singing in retirement homes, if it's going into children's hospitals or going into AIDS wards or whatever, take all of that, because all of that experience will help you to evolve as an artist.
Do you think you still learn from that experience and those ones you just referenced even today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I say this all the time. Every day I'm trying to evolve, and I take everything from every experience, and all of it feeds me, and all of it informs me, and all of it educates me. Every bit of it. And that's the good as the bad. I think Maria Callas talked about the fact that when she was studying with one of her early teachers, she would come to her teacher's studio, and she would listen to all of the students. And she said, and I learned just as much from the bad students as I did from the good ones. She took that education everywhere she could get it. And I feel the same way.
I do just want to very quickly mention the Actors Fund, because I know that you've worked with them alongside a host of many charities, because you give so much of your time outside of performing. And I want to mention the Dreamgirls cast album, because it's interesting how I can imagine an experience that you went in wanting to support the Actors Fund, but actually I can imagine it's quite an important, a crucial part of your career, because that's a show, a benefit, and an album that people listen to all the time. It's certainly one of my favorites. Was this an extraordinary experience as it seems from the outside?
Oh, it was. And given that it happened, 9-10 days after 9/11, when we actually did that, I mean, none of us were expecting 9/11 to happen. And the fact that we decided the show must go on, and not only is the show going to go on, but we're going to make sure that we have all the first responders that we can in the audience to honor them, to give them a moment to not think about what's just happened, or to at least sort of experience something else other than, you know, digging through the rubble day after day, or the, you know, dealing with the PTSD. So it was as electric, and it almost was like a, you know, time had no concept. It was there was no time in that I guess 2.5 hours that we did that show that night. There was no time. It was just we were suspended in this magical place. I don't know, but like, I don't know. It felt like Xanadu or something, in terms of just like, we're all suspended in time here. And every emotion that was being experienced, and every sort of moment, musical or, you know, just like every moment that was happening on that stage was electrifying. And everybody was feeling the same thing at the same time for every single minute of that 2 hours and 30 minutes or whatever it was, audience and performers.
It's a piece of history. It really is a piece of history for many reasons.
The first time that the whole entire show was recorded. Mm. That's the other thing. Not many people knew all of Dreamgirls. I mean, it's an opera basically, and not many people knew all of it, because the cast album, the original Broadway cast album, cut out so much of it. And I think Michael Bennett was not happy about that. I'm pretty sure he was not happy about that. But so what we were able to do was set down the entire show, you know, to be recorded. And that was, I know, I mean, I heard rumors. I know that Beyonce listened a lot to our album to prepare for the film that they did, you know, because it's one of the only sort of recordings of the entire show.
Beyonce listening to your voice, that's to me sounds like a very strange experience. Like, what? How does that happen? But it's extraordinary. And I'm so glad that I got the opportunity to mention it to you, because it genuinely, I know we're not allowed favorites. I know that's not allowed to happen, but I think it might be one of my favorite things that you've ever done. It's so good.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And I just had a baby. I think my 21-year-old was 8 months old at the time, 9 months old, something like that. So it was a wild time. It really was.
Now, I joked at the start about us not knowing or whatever the kid's saying of Yas is, or, you know, killing it or slaying it or whatever it was at the start. But did you know when you did the Ladies Who Lunch viral, did you know that you were going to become a viral moment? Did you know you were going to trend?
No, we thought we were not going to have careers the next day. I am not even kidding you. I think Christine has talked about this. She wrote us and she said, well, my darlings, either things will go well tomorrow when they air this, or that's the end of our careers as we know it, but oh well. Yeah, when Christine came up with this idea, you know, we were at, Meryl and I were like, okay, yeah, sure, that'd be great, yeah, let's do it. And then we started working on it, and we were all getting so frustrated, like, oh, this is terrible. I'm on take like 96, and still not working, I don't feel good about it. What do you think of this take? I mean, it was, in the end, we were like, oh, I don't know if this is going to be any good. We were very insecure about it. So we were all very stunned that it became what it became.
Were the bathrobes your idea, or was that Meryl's fault?
That was, who came up with that idea? I'm sure it was Christine or Meryl. They're the brains of that operation. And I just said, okay, I'll do whatever you guys say. But maybe it was Christine's idea, but the whole idea, we have to not look, we have to just look like we're stuck at home, and, you know, we can't, you know, no one can go out, we're stuck, we're drinking. And so, you know, because we all recorded it separately on our own time. And then, you know, we were all showing each other's tapes. I was like, you guys, because we were supposed to look kind of messy. And so I went for the messy look. I'm like, Christine's got lipstick on. I felt like I didn't get the same memo they did, but that's all right. It all turned out well.
You've literally given TikTok and drag queens content for the rest of their lives doing that video. You do know that, right?
Well, then I feel blessed for that.
There's just a couple of very quick final questions, because you've been incredibly kind with your time. I wanted to save it towards the end because I wanted to make sure that we did it justice, because I would love to talk about Stephen Sondheim just very briefly, because he is the most extraordinary talent, and it still feels like a very bizarre conversation to be having about him no longer being with us. I know that Company's just closed on Broadway and had the most remarkable success in London. And I know that he's been such a fundamental part of your career, with a little bit of time since his passing, and just getting the opportunity, I imagine, to go down memory lane and think about the way in which he impacted your career. What are your lasting memories of him?
You know, it's still not real to me that he's gone. You know, it's still, I still get really emotional thinking about the fact that he's gone. My lasting memories of him are vast, because there's so many, and we had a relationship, you know, for so many years, as I think just basically as he always felt like a teacher to me. And I guess I could call him a colleague, but I don't feel that's right. It's always more of, he always felt like he was in teacher mode with me. So, and he was so supportive, and but a teacher nonetheless, you know, because obviously there was the very public time where it seemed that he was not very supportive when he wrote the letter to the New York Times about our article and our production of Corgi and Bess. But he saw everything I did and wrote to me constantly. He offered me suggestions about not only just songs of his to sing, other songs that I should look at. When I was doing something of his, you know, when I did all those shows at Ravinia, we did that whole Stephen Sondheim over the course of 4 or 5 years, me, Patti LaPone, and Michael Cerveris doing a lot of his shows there. He was very involved with all of that. I mean, I'm not being very eloquent at all. You know, I always connected with him on his birthday. I always wished him a happy birthday. I sent him videos or sing to him, or I have my kids sing to him. And it was a deep, special relationship. And my guess is there's a lot of people that can say that. There's a lot of people in the business that had that kind of a relationship. And I'm just glad that I was one of the people to have that. And when he loved something you did, there was no one more effusive than Steve. And so I have almost like, I mean, just, I have in my possession a lot of beautiful, rapturous, almost like love letters, not to me, you know, as a person, but of, you know, what he had seen me do, or how moved he was by some of my work or something like that, or even sometimes things of his that I sang, you know. So, and when I needed to work on stuff, I've got letters that allude to that as well. So it's a big loss. It's a big loss.
What a life to have lived, to have been lucky enough to have him part of it. That feels special.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very, very lucky. Very, very lucky. I think Christine Baranski said it best when she said, after we found out that he died, she wrote and she said, well, we're orphans now, aren't we?
Mm. Wow. What a way with words he always has, but that feels particularly true. And to have lived with him in our industry and in our lives feels very special. So I definitely share the love that you just gave for him. Thank you so much for giving me so much of your time today. I have one final question about coming to London, then I'm going to let you go continue your life as Dame Audra in the real world away from me. But just to say thank you so much once again. And we've spoken through this entire conversation about so many hurdles, so many challenges, but also so many success stories that you've had in the varying different art forms that you've managed to be able to work in, if it's acting, singing, on stage, on screen, so on and so forth. When we think back to the advice that you were just saying that you give to younger people about how perhaps they could put their best foot forward and to lead with their authenticity, when you think back to all the successes you've had, being inducted into the Musical Theatre Hall of Fame, meeting President Obama, the Emmys, Grammys, Tony Awards, etc., what do you think all of this would have meant to that young girl that so much and so much wanted to long to be in this industry and to have just a small bit of the success that you've had? What would all this have meant to her?
I don't know what she would have done if she had known that, you know. I think if I could go back and talk to her, I'd say, dream even bigger, because it's going to be bigger than you ever imagined. And trust that you are on the right path, and who you are, and all the crazy emotions you feel, all of that, and the way that you feel alive when you sing, trust all of that, because that's going to serve you. And maybe, you know, trust that and dream as big as you possibly can.
The perfect way to end. Audra McDonald, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so, so, so much for your time. Most importantly, good luck. The 25th of September, the world famous London Palladium. I am so freaking excited. I hope you are too. And just thank you so much for your time again. It's such an honor and a privilege. And just thank you, thank you, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, William.
Amazing. I will see you in hopefully some rather fabulous dresses in London very soon.
Yes, darling. God, I hope so.
You've been listening to 11, the official theatre podcast. Find out more about 11 at 11podcast.com or via the Broadway Podcast Network. Hello and welcome to 11, the official theatre podcast that brings the biggest stars and creatives together in one place to discuss life in the arts. She's the Emmy, Grammy and six-time Tony Award-winning powerhouse that's officially the most decorated star in Broadway history. She's the Emmy, Grammy and six-time Tony Award-winning powerhouse that's officially the most decorated star in Broadway history, with more performance wins than any other actor, and is the only person to win all four acting categories.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.